sunrise. When Jake's old man shook him away with whiskey on his breath, stranger's lipstick on his face. He put a cigarette to his lips, how to steady his trembling nerves. And he stared at his boy in the silence, just trying to find the words. And he said, I was born a drifter, just a no good guitar picker, and my soul belongs to the West Texas wind. And I've been running to the ground by this mean old redneck town, and I don't think I'm coming back again. I sure ain't gave you much to miss, so take care of your ma and your sis, and won't you promise me one thing? Well, I've never known success, so boy, you do your best to turn out better. For school, he was quick with his fist, just a slick back rock and roller by the time we heard Elvis. And I lived down the alley at night, I'd hear his guitar play. He was practicing for when he'd meet his old man on the stage. And he said, I was born a drifter, just a no good guitar picker, and my soul belongs to the West Texas wind. And I've been running to the ground by this mean old redneck town, and I don't think I'm coming back. I sure ain't gave you much to miss, so take care of your ma and your sis, and won't you promise me one thing? Well, I've never known success, so boy, you do your best to turn out better than me. Yeah, I've never known success, so boy, you do your best to turn out better than me.
And that's Eric Heiss with an original, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a song I wrote about 10 years ago. It was on a record I put out called Nature of the Blues.
Very nice, man. Your stuff is always so, you tell such a story with it. You come from a long tradition of that you've always liked the balladeer type stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. That's what got me into the whole thing, you know, is that I wanted to write and tell stories, and I had an interest in short story fiction, but the attention span of a rock and roller.
You know? Of a millennial.
I guess I had the aspirations of John Steinbeck, but the attention span of Eddie Cochran.
Oh, God. Jesus, this blew everyone's mind. You know, this is just a cruise station, dude. Locally, they're not going to know what you're talking about. No, that's great. I appreciate you coming in. This is a rare opportunity for us here in Las Cruces because you are from here, but you moved off to Austin.
Yeah, we live in Austin, Texas.
And that was many years ago that you moved. What year did you end up going to Austin originally?
I moved to Austin the first time in 1990. Yeah. A friend of mine from high school and I, we were traveling around kind of in our, you know, beatnik traveling guy phase, and we wanted to move to Memphis, Tennessee. And we went to Memphis and we couldn't find any sort of opportunities at all. It was, at the time, it was really, really difficult to live there. And there's a lot of great stuff going on in Memphis. I just wasn't able to find it because... Yeah. There was no such thing as the internet back then. And it was really hard to tell what was going on.
People there.
Yeah, I didn't know anybody. So... we packed up and ended up moving to Austin with two musician friends, met us there. Kenta Henme and John Reed met us there in Austin. And that was the first time I lived there in 1990. And I've come and gone a few times, most substantially and notoriously in 1997 when we had our band.
That's right.
When we put our group together that played all over the place.
Oh, yes. For any locals who remember The Last Man on Earth, that was quite a wild ride, man.
It was definitely.
It burned brightly.
Yeah, sometimes I call it my John Lennon's Lost Weekend, but it was a wild time. You know, we had a great band, and it was interesting. I feel like I myself was the least accomplished of everybody in the band. Like you and Dave Chavez had been out in Los Angeles and had done a lot of stuff. Well, and Dave had been in Albuquerque and done and had the Johnny Cats, which were a really popular band.
That's right. Yeah.
I don't know how much they didn't accomplish a lot of music business, but they made a lot of fans and they were great. They were busy. Yeah. And then Chris Church has been an extremely talented and accomplished musician since the day I met him when he was a teenager. And so we threw our thing together and we had a lot different experience than your average local band because we'd all traveled around and done a lot of stuff. And so we fell together and immediately started just burning it up. You
that
know?
Was crazy, man.
And we were all probably at the pinnacle of craziness in our lives.
Well,
too,
yeah, so. I know. There's a lot of abuse going on back then. But that's when you were young enough to, you know, we could do it, you know, mid-20s, I guess.
Yeah, I think I was 24, 25
years old. Yeah, I was about there.
You know, what else are you going to do?
So. Well, we were still chasing the dream. And always are. I guess it's not like we ever stopped. It's just that was the coming together of four different entities that really worked out well, man. And it did burn. It burned so hot that there was no way it could continue. It was either going to go like over the top or just kind of going into the dirt.
Yeah, and it was an odd time too because again, I'm sure that people in the know had the internet in 1998, or 97 whatever. But we didn't really. We didn't have a lot of. It was hard to put things together. You know, touring and traveling was all done by phone call or postcard or. What you know, you get to
remember. I got us a 1-800 number.
That's right. We had a 1-800 number.
1-800-4-LMOE.
Yeah, that's right.
I thought we'd arrived, man.
Yeah, but we played everywhere. We played in Albuquerque and Socorro, and I'm going to tell the story about playing in Socorro here a little bit. And El Paso a whole lot. That was when Bombardiers was going and Wild Hares was going. That was
Amigo Air Show.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Good heavens.
And then we went down to Austin and Houston twice, I think. So
Yeah.
We played Taco Land in San Antonio. We did all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that was fun, man. I remember when I went, let's see, how did that work? We went, it was in Houston. Mary
Cutrefello, who
was it Mary Jane's?
Mary Jane's is the bar.
The bar. Yeah,
that's right, yeah.
And I got there, and I had just gotten off the road, and I was tired, and I went in to the bar, and we were kind of, you know, figuring things out, just kind of sitting down. And I was so tired, and I put my head down on this table, and you're like, dude, you can't do that here. They're going to kick you out of here. If you put your head down on the table, they'll kick you out of the bar.
Yeah, 86 you before you even get a chance to hit your drums.
I'm just tired. Yeah, sure, get out of here. That was fun, man.
That was some really fun.
You might as well tell that Socorro story, though, because
well, we were, you know, for those out there who don't know, we started playing at Hurricane Alley. Hurricane Alley was half or a third the size that it is now.
Right.
And we were playing there all the time, playing at the club. And then we started trying to branch out. And Wild Hares in El Paso was one of the first places we played. So somehow or another, we found that there's a bar in Socorro. It's a beautiful, we just passed it, actually. It's a beautiful old west kind of bar on the square. I know everybody's driven through Socorro a million times, but there's a really pretty downtown, like it looks like Old Mesilla kind of.
Yeah.
And there's a bar there called the Capitol Bar. So we managed to get booked into there. And it's one of those deals. We have to bring the whole PA. We have to bring all this stuff in.
Yeah.
And I remember we get out of the van and we're loading we're carrying in all this heavy stuff that we have. And Chris is over on the phone with his girlfriend. He's on the payphone talking to her. And I remember Dave Chavez, each time he walks by, he's singing Every Rose Has Its Thorn by Poison. You know, because it's like the first time Chris is like, you know, quote unquote, gone on the road since he's, you know, which is two hours north to Socorro.
And, right.
So then we get loaded in and we start playing. And there was a guy there who I had seen, and a guy who's way older than us. I'd seen him at El Patio before. He's this big, tall dude. Right. And he was there with his soon-to-be ex-wife. And they were telling me how they were getting divorced, but they had come out to the bar together. And we're playing, and she starts dancing. She's out there dancing with the guy who looked like Freddie Mercury, you know, the full leather. He looked like the leather guy from The Village People.
Right.
And this guy was out there dancing, and he was like voguing, you know, he would like dance for a little bit and then stop and pose. And she and him are dancing away out there. It's not really like a big crowd.
Or voguing music, for that matter.
Or the type of music that you would do that to. And so we're playing this song, and we hit the last chord, and there's just an explosion of what it sounds like when your amp falls over with the reverb turned up. And and I think that Chris had done it. Like, I think Chris had bought some new effects pedal, you know, as I'm looking over, you know, because I was always on him to be less heavy metal. You know?
Sure, yeah.
I'm looking at Chris, and he's looking at me like, what happened? And we look over, and this woman has, like, spun around and fallen, and she's hit the PA mixer. And knocked the PA mixer sideways, which is what caused that noise. And I remember she's laying there splayed out on the floor. And I walk over to help her up. And I'm like, you know, are you okay? Are you all right? I go, did you hit your head? And she stands up and she goes, no, I hit my cheek. And the leather guy behind her walks up and he goes, well, your cheek is part of your head. He had no sympathy whatsoever. You know, he was more concerned with the syntax than the state of her mental affairs.
You know what? I'm sorry. I remember that from behind you guys because I was sitting down. And I remember I didn't see her actually make contact with it.
I didn't either.
But I saw her fly across in between you and Dave, and then like the boom at the end.
One of my other favorite things from that show is, you know, Socorro is where the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology is.
Yeah.
So there's a certain like demographic that would go to a school like that. And
sure.
I remember we're getting out of the van and this guy walks up to me and goes, hey man, you guys are the band? He goes, did you bring any girls?
Yeah, we carry our own group.
And I was like, yeah, man, that's not really how this works.
That's your job, yeah. Man.
We're like the Vikings, man. We didn't go. We're not bringing you girls. We came to take your girls.
We come to take yours back to Greece's. That's what we call Valhalla around here. Oh, man. I hadn't thought about that a long time.
Yeah, that was one of many just insane
there
times.
You know what? Let's listen to one of the songs off the CD that you
All
brought
right.
me. And then I want to talk to you about, you know, today that we're recording this is St. Patrick's Day. Just happens to be. And there's a little story about being on the rooftop of a local restaurant on St. Patrick's Day that we'll get to after this song. So let me ask you, what song do you want to hear?
Well, let's play the second song, the title track, which is called Street Lamp.
Street, okay.
This record, it's a newish record. It came out last July, September. The cover is a photo of the cemetery here in Las Cruces.
Oh, it is.
My wife Angie took that picture right after we had eaten lunch down there on Mesquite Street, and this song is it features the accordion work of a great New Mexico accordion player named Josh Baca, who lives in San Antonio now and plays with a band called Los Tex Maniacs. And it's just a song that I wrote about a little vignette about a situation early on in me and my wife's relationship.
Okay, fair enough. So here it is. Let's take a listen.
Staring at me, cause I'm just looking for a place to be alone with my girl, away from this world that I'll never understand, sharing a kiss beneath an abandoned street lamp. Never fails to catch me by surprise. My heart beating fast neath the blue-black sky. As I watch you walk over the broken glass diamonds and the rocks to where I stand and share a kiss beneath. motions of my day. And I see the world in a different way than I did last night. In that circle of faded yellow light, holding hands, sharing a kiss beneath an abandoned street lamp. Sharing a kiss beneath an abandoned street lamp.
And that's Eric Hysaw with Street Lamp. Now, what's your take on that? What was the thought process behind that?
I had this idea that I wanted to write a song that was sort of like a like an oldie, kind of like a Drifters or Platters, like that old, you know, oldies but goodies kind of thing, but not recorded at Fabulous and Atlantic Studios with strings and stuff, but recorded by like a San Antonio garage band.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a, you know, like a four piece rock and roll band playing a song, but it's kind of got that like oldies feel to it.
It does.
And it's, you know, it's a romantic song. So I wanted that kind of, sort of like Dion and the Belmonts kind of thing going, but with a rock and roll band instead of a studio, you know, instead of a studio group doing it. So
this is awesome. Where can people pick up this CD?
My favorite place for people to get it is from the website, my website, which is www.erichysaw.com, and that's like a PayPal, get it mailed right, you know, from my house to your house deal. Right. But it's also on a thing called Bandcamp, and
for the digital download.
Yeah, the digital downloads on Bandcamp, and then there's a whole bunch of other places that, you know, you can stream it and all that stuff if that's what you do. But, you know, everybody needs to keep in mind that it takes like 10,000 streams to equal one CD sale. So
that's right.
So just a little PSA, you're not supporting your favorite band unless you stream their song 10,000 times.
That's right. Or buy it directly from their website.
Yeah, that's supporting your favorite
Cut out
artist.
The middleman. No, I agree. Yeah. Okay, so you got your band here is Neil Walker on bass. Are these current members?
No, none of these guys are.
Okay, so this is
I've burned all these guys out by now. Right?
Except for Josh Baca, who
Justin, he don't play. He's just a studio. What would you call it? A special guest.
Did you know him here in Cruz?
No, he's from Albuquerque. He's quite a bit younger than I am.
He's good though. That's it.
Yeah, he's great.
Good player.
He does a lot of cool stuff. He goes out and plays with Los Lobos and plays with all kinds of people.
Oh,
and
really?
Wow. He and his uncle's name is Max Baca, and they've been playing you know, traditional conjunto music in San Antonio for years. And they brought down their thing that they did in Albuquerque in their own special style. Yeah. But they hooked up with the Smithsonian Institute Folkways Records, and they go play all these festivals all over the world. Like, they're I was seeing on the internet, he's in Czechoslovakia playing conjunto music in Czechoslovakia, which is so cool, man.
I always wonder how people do that, you know? I mean, I know I've had kids and that type of stuff, but, you know, people are always talking about, oh no, we're off in, you know, Tasmania this week or something. How the hell do they get down there? How do they pull that off?
It's hard. I've been overseas a few times, and it's like it's
you're one of
hard,
them.
Then. Hard to do, but
Cooper does that. Do you know Cooper?
A little bit, yeah, not well, but yeah.
You guys should pair up because
I'm always keeping my eye on what he's doing because I'm really proud of him for coming from here. And I mean, well, hell, this is a big city for him.
I know, right, anymore.
He's from out there in the middle of nowhere.
Getting bigger all the time, man.
He's from some really small town, I remember, and he's just, you know, out there doing it all the time. Just, and he's one of those dudes that, like, he plays drums and he, you know.
I know.
You know, it's cool. I like that a lot.
You know, I do too. In my heart of hearts, I do, but there's a certain jealousy factor for me too. I was like, one guy should not be able to do everything like that, but that's okay. Good for him. You're right. But I was gonna mention the St. Patrick's Day story, and that's when it was called Bennigan's.
That's right, yeah.
Now it's called, what, O'Doul's or something?
I seriously don't.
Not O'Doul's. Called O'Doul's. But
there's no money in that whatsoever. That would be the most uncapitalistic bargain ever.
I think it's
called O'Charlie's or something like
that. O'Charlie's.
Yeah. It's something.
It's a restaurant for, well, this is a local show, so on the corner of Locust and University. Everyone here knows where Benning's used to be. But it was the first year they did it, I think. Yeah. I don't know how on earth we talked him into doing it, but we said, look, let us put a PA and a full band set up on the roof and let all the bands play on the roof.
That's right.
And I can't imagine why they said okay, but they did.
Yeah, I can't remember how we got up there. I think
it was a cherry picker scissor lift,
and we put all that stuff up there, all that same stuff that we used to have to carry into the barge. And
we trusted the roof of that place.
And the wind was blowing, as it is known to do here in March, like 60-mile-an-hour winds. I've seen the video of it, and we all have like a bald spot on the side of our head where the wind is like spraying.
And we gave our camera to Kenta to run around and take video, and he actually did a pretty good job, you know, considering the fact that, you know, everyone was drinking a lot of beer and given a video camera, you know, he had a little free rein there. But I should post that video. But I'm trying to remember. That's what Dave and Chris, and we played first, I believe.
I think so. Yeah. I think
and there were like our girlfriends and like the vendors getting set up for our whole show. Man, it was like, oh, what are we doing here? But that's one of my most fond memories of that group, was being up on that roof and watching the cars come down University and. Almost hitting each other because they were looking at us instead of the car in front of them, you know.
Yeah.
I thought they're going to have a wreck and there's going to be all this commotion. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
But it never happens. So.
I'm sure there was a couple of train wrecks that happened that day. But.
Well, yeah. At least on the stage. Yeah. I'm surprised no one fell off.
That was dangerous.
You know, it was.
With the wind and...
That was back in the day.
Yeah, we were fearless.
You could do things without... Anyway. Well, do you have another song on your guitar? You could do a singer-songwriter type thing.
I have another song.
Have you written more than one song in your life?
I've got several. I don't write as fast as I used to. this is a song that before we get into talking about our late great rock and roll star friends.
Right.
This song is... I came up with this right after I heard about Dave Chavez passing away, but in a way it's about both Dave and Bugs, and I guess retroactively about Kenta too. This song's called Clouds. You won't believe me, you thought I was lying when I told your story. I kept it simple, I stuck to the facts, and they said there ain't nobody like that. 'Cause there's a beauty in your madness, a poetry in your sadness, and there's a cloud hanging low tonight. Come to bridges that you left behind. You won't make it home unless you walk through the fire. Still, you never want to be denied. You say the first words that crossed your mind. 'Cause there's a beauty in your madness, a poetry. Sadness, and there's a cloud hanging low tonight. You're out there where everyone pushed you away. They'd rather talk about you than to you any day. No one believe me,
thought I was lying when I told your story tonight. But I kept it simple, I stuck to the facts, and they said there ain't nobody like that. 'Cause there's a beauty in your madness, a poetry in your sadness, and there's a cloud hanging low. There's a cloud hanging low. There's a cloud hanging low tonight.
Very appropriate, man. That was about Dave, huh?
Yeah, that sounds about our good buddy, Mr. Dave Chavez.
Dave Chavez. Man, it's so true, man. What an interesting guy to know, you know?
Yeah, the night that I heard that David passed away, I was at a rehearsal, and I was, and of course, as it would be, you know, you take a break, and I'm telling my, telling the people I'm working with about him, and I'm looking at their faces, and I can tell they don't believe my story. You know, right. And I'm like, you know, that's what gave me the idea for this song. Is it says, you know, no one believed me. They thought I was lying when I told your story. And it's like, I mean, yeah. It was this dude was a mix of contradictions. It was just unbelievable.
Oh, amazing! Yeah,
you know, so talented. This guy could play bass like nobody's business.
I've never met a better. I mean, I'm sorry to all the bass players I've played with, but I mean, Chavez. I mean, I don't know.
His touch and his feel and playing, and it was really, so natural. Really, it came so natural to him, and then, you know, he was way ahead of the curve as far as doing graphic design and on computers and stuff. And his eye for detail was incredible. And his ability to, his conversational ability and his humor was like unbelievable.
Very quick.
And for me, like, Dave and I both had roots up in the Hatch Valley and Garfield. You know, my dad had hung out with his aunts and stuff. And so we were really like family. And, of all the great things about Dave, he also had the ability to infuriate you. And of all the times that I was infuriated with Dave, it wasn't like I had a choice. It wasn't like I could not walk away from Dave and say, you know, and say, this is it, I'm done with you. Because he was, for all intents and purposes, a brother to me, you know.
Sure.
And just an amazing person, amazing mix of contradictions. And it's a shame that there's musicians and people like that nobody knows. You know, if Dave Chavez were sitting in a room next to one of the most famous bass players in the whole world, you know, playing music, that guy would see him as an equal, even though nobody knows who Dave was. You know, nobody in the grander scale knows who Dave was. And it's just it's a shame, but what a...
Well, he lived, you know, he lived it out. You know, I don't know how else to put it, you know.
He made, just like all of our friends that have passed away, he made his choices. He didn't, it wasn't some, nobody forced him in that direction. He did those things himself. And so you can't really, like, you know, whine about it, but
I guess we all figured it would happen at some point.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And I feel kind of bad, you know, because the last time I saw him was when he came by the house, he came by the studio. And I was right in the middle of a mix that I had to wait for, and I thought it was somebody else, and it was Dave out there, and I knew that Dave wanted me to do something, and I was just like, I'll have to call him back.
Yeah,
I can't do it. And then he died later that week.
Yeah,
and I think, it took me a while to get over that.
That is a hard one, you know.
But you know what I'm talking about, man. When I say, you know, it wasn't as though I didn't want to deal with him or talk with him. It's just, you knew that when Dave came around, there was going to be some commitment, that you were going to have to get into something.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to see it through, because he's, like you said, he could be incredibly talented, but with that came this tenacity, and he loved it, his needle, you know, just, why? I don't know.
in the song, which is called Clouds, I said, there's a line in the bridge where I say, you're out there where everyone pushed you away. They'd rather talk about you than to you.
Yeah, I heard that.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, and I'd started, I used to talk to Dave on the phone a lot.
in Austin, I have a delivery job that I've been doing for 100 years, and my job would allow me just pockets of time that I would have to kill a little bit of time, and I'd talk to him on the phone. But there were a bunch of times when I just would see that, you know, I can't answer the phone right now.
Yeah,
you know?
I can't dedicate the time to it.
Because there would be a lot of guilt trips and stuff going on. And and then I felt really bad about that. And then,
no, but it's true. You know, what are you going to do, man? You know?
And moving on to another one, our friend Bug Salcido, who passed away after Dave a few years. I had the very amazingly good fortune of being in Joshua Tree, 29 Palms, California, that area.
Yeah, where he was.
Where he was, and I ran into him. I reached out to him. I knew he might be there, so I reached out to him, and we had a great time together. I played the gig that I played that night. I was playing guitar for someone else, and he was living at the motel that we were staying at.
Right.
Which, you know, on one hand, you go, oh, my God, I've traveled all across the country, and I'm staying at this motel where one of my mentors is living. But then if you know the area, it's like, of course, that's what happened. You know?
Right.
there wasn't any other options. That's how it happened that way for a reason. But
yeah.
But Bugs asked me, he says, hey, come over, you know, come over to my room and jam.
Yeah.
And I'd been sitting in a van all day and, you know, had the show, had to wait around to play. And there was part of me that thought, oh man, I don't want to do that. You know, I'm so tired.
Yeah.
And then the switch flipped. I go, no, I'm going to Bugs's room. And we sat down and played guitars together like I was 15, you know, years old again.
Right.
Played all the same songs, all the same stuff he taught me, you know, Wild Horses, Dead Flowers.
Because he was your mentor as a young player.
Oh, yeah, in a lot of ways. And yeah. Maybe they were married at the time. Widow at the time was there, mm-hmm. and he launched into some of his rock and roll stories and told him as if he was, you know, as if he were accepting a Grammy, which, you know, is another Bugs thing. And we had just an absolutely great night. And the next morning, right before we were leaving, I introduced him to some of the people that I was playing with. And for some reason, I can't remember what I wasn't going to do something he wanted me to. And he whipped out and pulled his knife on me to convince me to do something. And now it's like, and you know, this had happened a whole lot of times, but now it's the digital age. So when he pulled his knife out on me, I got my phone camera and I took a picture. So I have a photograph of Bugs whipping out his butterfly knife,
oh,
you know, threatening
God.
Me about something, Bugs. You know, jokingly, I'm sure.
To a point.
Yeah. 75% joking.
This shows you that I really do wish you would do this.
Yeah.
Oh, Bugs.
But it was so great. It was so great to see him. And then later on that trip, I was in Albuquerque, and I was at Kenta's house. And me and Kenta were in the basement of his house, and we played one of Bugs' songs and recorded it on the phone. And I even sang it in my best Bugs impersonation, and I sent it to him on his voicemail, and he wrote me back and left me this long voicemail saying that was like the greatest gift he could have ever received, and it was very sincere.
That's,
you know?
Cool,
and,
though, yeah.
And so then when he passed away, which I could definitely see coming also,
yeah,
I felt a lot better about it, because I felt like we had that moment that I'm really glad I didn't walk away from, you know.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean, so when you're out there traveling, it's like, it's hard to sometimes to get up and go see somebody, because you're wore out, and then maybe like if you're playing in a band, your band members don't understand why you would be doing this. And
if you've got a crew, then that's another thing. But yeah, when you got to do it all yourself, man, it's tough.
But it was really good to see him like that. Right,
that is cool.
Yeah,
I you know, he has some of the most rock and roll type stories I've ever known. I remember he'd come around here. Well, he's the one who helped me install a bunch of the lights there in the studio. And
yeah, surprisingly for...
Very helpful. You know, I mean, no reason.
For someone who wore that many robes and eyeliner, he actually had a lot of skills.
Like a lot true.
A lot of construction skills.
Kid could swing a hammer, man.
Yeah, and it's throw true. A punch. Yeah.
But you know what? I mean, one night, yeah. And he... what happened? Oh, he had my chainsaw. And I kept saying, Bugs, I need my chainsaw back. And I don't know why. This has been years and years. But finally I said, man, if you don't give me my chainsaw, I'm going to come to your house, I'm going to punch you in the face, and I'm going to take my chainsaw. And so, me, you're not going to do that. So I'm like, okay, I'm going. So this is back when he was down on Van Patten. And I went to his place, and I go to his door, and I bang, bang, and I look down, and my chainsaw's sitting outside the door. So I get the chainsaw, and I'm thinking, I should like to slice this guy's front door open with this chainsaw. And so I tried, but it didn't start. It wouldn't work anymore.
It was out of gas. Yeah.
I think it was rusted. He left it in the rain. But he's also one of those guys who has the coolest rock and roll story of being passed out on the gazebo down in Mesilla with a half bottle of whiskey in one hand and a revolver in the other.
Wow, yeah.
You remember that?
That was sort of at a time when I wasn't that much in touch with
bugs. Right. It was during a transitional period.
Yeah. I have this very funny thing. One time, I talk to Bugs on the phone every so often.
Right.
And he calls me up one time and he tells me this long story about he was in San Francisco, and he was always tight with those Camper Van Beethoven Cracker guys. And he had a gig opening up for one of the guys from Camper Van Beethoven, who's a real well-known fiddle player. His name's Jonathan Siegel. And Jonathan Siegel was playing with this guy named Eugene Chadbourne, who's like a legend, underground, avant-garde music legend. Mm. So Bugs is opening up the show for him, and he's got this act going where he wears all these robes and stuff, and he plays a little tiny concertina, and he comes out for his show playing the sad minor key song on the concertina with all these robes, and he's got shakers and tambourines taped to his ankles, so he's like stomping, limping through the crowd as he's walking, so it's, making this noise, and he's playing the sad song on the concertina.
Was he wearing the devil mask?
I'm sure wearing the El Diablo mask, which is exactly like so. So then he gets on stage and he has a record player, a variable speed, old, what do they call it? Caliphone record player. And he has some records that he's cut slices in, and he puts them on the turntable and mics the record player. So it makes a noise that's like,
right.
And it's in time with the song he's playing. So that's his drum machine, his percussion.
Yeah.
And this show, that he's telling me about, sounds terrific. And it's really cool. But then he told me he let a whole bunch of people in on the guest list if they would buy one of his t-shirts.
Okay.
And then he won't quit playing when his time is up. So he starts this thing with the band he's opening for. And as the story goes on, it gets more crazy, and he's got somebody in a headlock, and he's pulling a knife on him, and he's doing this, and he's doing
Bugs
that.
That knife.
I think the knife came out about five times in this story. And then so he tells me this whole thing, and I'm just, oh my God, this is too much. And then he finishes it with, he goes, so hey man, I'm thinking about coming out to Austin. Can you hook me up with anything? And I'm just like, oh, I'm actually moving, man.
Oh my God. Something about Bugs would always bring out kind of your rebellious side, though.
Oh yeah.
That he stayed with me one time in LA when he was passing through. And we were drinking a little bit, and there was a guy downstairs who was bad to his girlfriend. I don't think it was his wife, but he was leaving, and Bugs said something like, what's the deal with that guy? Or, what's his story, man? And I said, this guy's, he beats his wife, but we don't like him too much. So anyway, we get drinking and decide the thing that I should do was write a note to this guy that says, look, you need to lay off of your woman. It's none of my business, of course, but I'm going to come down there and deal with you. I don't remember what I put, but something like that. So I go down there and he's already home. I thought he was still gone, but and I tape the note to his door, and then I slam it, slap it real hard, but the door kind of opens a little bit. Breaking and entering, Oops, going to bleep that. Hang on. There we go. I marked it. But yeah, that's a major deal. So I go upstairs, and of course the guy calls the cops, and I'm upstairs and just kind of waiting, thinking I'm going to go to jail. And the cop comes in, and I'm pleading my case. This guy is always beating up his girlfriend, and she doesn't deserve that, and whatever. And Bugs is kind of standing beside me like, yeah, yeah. And they make a point, and Bugs like, yeah, that's not right, man. The way he talks. I was like, thanks, Bugs. I got this, man. Because I figured, I was going to go. But actually, the cop was pretty cool and said, look, I understand, but this is none of your business. And then Bugs like, yeah, Dave, it's really none of your business. Like, God, he had my back two seconds ago, man. Oh, And I know that I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't been there drinking with Bugs, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I would, like I did 100 times before and just not worried about it. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing. We lost some good friends in the last, four or five years?
4 or 5 years, a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, when I was, really young, you know, I had been in a band, like we all started bands in our junior high school, yeah. You know, and you just play with whoever else has an instrument, you know, like, oh yeah, I play guitar, you got, you know, let's try to do something. And you know, you get older, you find more people. And I had, gotten, you know, kicked out of my junior high school band for musical differences. And, and then I ended up meeting Bugs through a girl named Donna Gorham. Who was playing bass at the time. I don't think she really pursued music much after that. But so I met Bugs, and he was going back and forth between Los Angeles and Houston and coming to Las Cruces sometimes. And he was like, I mean, he looked like Mark Bolan from T-Rex, crossed with Johnny Thunders, crossed with Keith Richards, Bob Dylan, you know. And he was this mythical rock and roll figure. And what we would do all the time is, there was no place to play, and we never had a real band together, like a band that had an actual, right. You know, I think Trey Miles was around playing drums with us sometimes, but we never had like a real thing. But what we would do is we you know, fashioned ourselves as very dedicated musicians, because we would sit on the porch of Max Butler's dad's house.
That's right.
I think Max Butler's dad, Gordon, had moved in with his girlfriend or something, and so he had sort of like left Max Butler this house, and Max went on to have a big record deal with the Sextants, and then played in a band called Red Meat out in San Francisco, and played guitar and pedal steel with Chuck Prophet. So Max has had like an amazingly great.
I think he's still playing.
I'm yeah, sure. He plays. I think he's more involved in church stuff and playing bluegrass. But I mean, this guy's an incredible musician.
Head kids and
done,
stuff.
Yeah, done all kinds of great stuff, but. We would sit on the porch at Max's, and Bugs would teach us all these songs that were like songs he felt like we had to know.
Right.
You know, and that was like, I definitely remember we were just listening to the Rolling Stones in the car, the song No Expectations by the Stones. I remember Bugs being like, you know, you need to know this song. You don't know this song. You're not going to. And it was like, and I got this feeling like, if I may never play this song live or play it in a band, but I need to know this song in order to write the songs that I'm going to write.
That's right. You
know,
it's a catalyst. Yeah,
exactly. And there was a bunch of them, and I've kind of compiled a list of them. And sometimes when I'll be playing an acoustic show, I'll just start reeling off all these, you know, Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash, mm-hmm. Dead Flowers by the Stones, just all these different songs that were like part of this canon of thing, you know. And that was where I really got my education from Bugs. And that was just such a valuable time. And
right.
I think he was about 10 years older than me. So, you know, when I was 14, 15 years old, he was in his mid 20s.
That sounds about
still,
right.
And yeah. Still doing all kinds of stuff. And then I feel like, unfortunately, in some ways, he got derailed by becoming a roadie for Cracker. He and the leader guy, David Lowry from Cracker, had actually grown up together in Riverside, California. And then Bugs and his family moved out here. And they were close enough that David Lowry used to come here to visit him when they were still kids.
Right.
But when David's thing took off with Cracker, Bugs became a roadie, and it changed where he became more interested in all of the rock star stuff than playing it. You know, he would tell me about all the stuff he was doing, you know, I met so-and-so, I'm doing this. It's like, but what gigs are you playing?
Yeah.
You know, where's your guitar? Yeah, and all these stories about famous people.
Yeah.
And that's,
I don't think they were very fair with Bugs either. I think they probably promised him a lot and never gave him what they promised him.
Yeah, oh, exactly.
You know, I think they kind of strung him along, and poor Bugs, he wanted it so bad.
Well, that's...
And I think he really had the goods, too. It's just...
There's so many great songs.
Well, the Bug 2000, I'm sure you can get that somewhere.
I don't know. I hope so. I found a machine that would digitize cassette tapes, and you could put a cassette tape in and put a thumb drive in it, and the thumb drive would have the music on it.
Oh, that's cool.
I don't know how it works. It's a mystery magical machine.
Yeah.
And I put a bunch of that stuff I have from Bugs on digital and sent it to his sister Christina and stuff to make sure that she has it. But some of that music is so, he was so talented, so good, he had a vision for it all. And he's a really tasty guitar player, and just overall, really, really good.
I've got some audio footage. Audio footage, does that work? I've got some audio from a radio show he did at KRWG a long time ago.
Oh, cool.
It was on one of the other shows.
Yeah.
I should put that on. You should check that out. I mean, just if you want to.
Yeah, I'd love to.
I'll do anything. This is about you, not about
Bob Fender. I'd love to have that.
I'll give you a copy of that. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, like a mutual friend of ours, James McCown.
Mm-hmm.
James is a guy from Las Cruces who played bass. He's the original bass player, I think, maybe the second bass player in the Footnotes, who were a band that did a whole lot of stuff.
Second, I think.
And then James moved out to Los Angeles, and he met this guy who's a drummer who tells him, well, my uncle is a great guitar player. And the guy and James is like, man, I didn't move out to LA to play with your uncle, you know. But the guy's uncle was only a few years older than him, and his name was Spike. And they put together this band called The Decadents. And they were like a heavy, trashy Stones meets New York Dolls kind of band. And the singer, they imported a singer from Las Cruces also. And they had their thing going, and they played at all the cool clubs in LA. And through James, I got to know James. I don't even really know how. And then through him, I got to know the other guys, Spike, the guitar player, who was Bugs' mentor.
Right.
So, like, in time, I found out all these things that Bugs was trying to, you know, like, you know, Bugs was like the, you know, the Zen master that wakes you up by hitting you with a stick, you know, it was like all the stuff that Bugs was trying to teach me by whacking me with a stick, you know, were things that Spike had taught him. You know? So now, like, it's really cool because I talk to Spike all the time and I'm still further delving into that knowledge that I was getting.
There's
when
still
I was 14.
More for you to learn.
Much, much more. Yeah, always more to learn.
Until you get to the point where you actually wake up and catch the stick before it hits you.
I'm still trying to catch that stick. Exactly.
That's when you know it's time to go out into the world and be your own man or whatever.
Yeah.
Or find someone. Do you find yourself mentoring younger musicians at all now?
I wish. I want so bad. I want a protege so bad.
Yeah, they're out
man. Young kids hate rock and roll. I don't know what to do.
Well, a lot do. But there's got to be some young strummer, you know, out there.
I know. Please, if somebody, you know, if there's a protege out there waiting for me, like, I want to know you. But no, I still play with all these dudes that are older than me.
Well,
that's like I'm always working with these guys like that were first wave punk rock dudes.
Yeah.
And so I've been trying to make a record with this guy in Austin who's in a Dallas punk band called the Nerve Breakers that opened for the Sex Pistols. We've been trying to make a record and do some stuff. And then I've been playing a little bit with this guy from San Antonio who was in one of the first San Antonio punk bands. And so I still hang out with guys that are 15, 20 years older than me all the time. I'm still the kid, you know?
Well, I guess you don't have to necessarily be older to mentor someone. I mean, you know, if they're older than you, you could probably take them under your wing.
The student-teacher role is probably way flipped over with these
kids. It's true. You don't know. You just haven't found them yet, man. They're out there. Your students out there somewhere. I mean, I don't know. Who knows? Well, listen. I wanna cap off that conversation with another one of your songs from your CD.
All right.
Which one do you want to hear?
Let's throw on the leadoff song, which is called "Hurry It Up."
Hurry It Up.
Which is just a little rock and roll thing that I just kind of threw the lyrics together quickly over a situation that was happening with some young kids at my wife's kid and his lady and stuff. Their romantic situation kind of sparked an idea for me, and I made up the song. And it was a funny thing is I was trying to come up with to fill in another verse. It's like a Stonesy rocker, and I saw over in the corner on the bookshelf. I was looking at the bookshelf, and I saw that there was the poet Rimbaud. The Season in Hell book was over on the bookshelf. And I thought, oh, I'm going to use that Season in Hell. And so when we're recording, this guy, Sean Somm, his dad is Doug Somm from the Texas Tornadoes. He has a lot of notoriety in the rock and roll business. But Sean Sean has a recording studio, and we're recording the song, and Sean goes, oh, Season in Hell, like Eddie and the Cruisers. And I'd forgotten about in the movie Eddie and the Cruisers, the guy who's like, he's the word man, and he's trying to bump Eddie and the Cruisers up to like another level of intensity. That Season in Hell is his book, you know. And that cracked me up because there's some parts of the song, too, that are very Eddie and the Cruisers. So this is that's a dead-end story about how this song has some kind of connection to the movie Eddie and the Cruisers.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's cool, man. Now, when you write a song these days, what's your process? Do you do the? We've talked about this, but you do like vocals, your lyrics first, or your licks first?
No, it all comes together at the same time. Usually, for me, what happens is I will get like a theme or an idea for what I want to write about, and then next I'll try to get a rhythm for it.
Right.
So you know, you think like okay, I got this thing I want to write about, and.
Excuse me.
And I'll start thinking, well, if I write, you know, if this is going to, you know, try to get this sort of idea, story out, like I need, you know, some kind of straight. So, you know.
Right.
So I'll pick up the guitar and start playing rhythms on that. And then hopefully, best case scenario, some kind of thing, you know, progression or a riff comes together.
Huh.
And then I'll try to get something that fits in there. I mean, sometimes you just get a line. Like, maybe you don't even have a story, but you have a line. And you go, okay, I'm going to write something around
right
this.
Right to the line?
Yeah, this line.
But because, well, I mean, you had, when you were, you know, singing the song, like, with Dave and that kind of thing, it's definitely a message that you're...
Oh, yeah. Well,
so
you
seem more like a...
I mean, that song, I think
poet,
I just...
Or is it different for every song?
Yeah, it's different. Because that song just came... I just wrote the whole thing, like, just from start to finish, you know?
Stabbing together.
Well, I guess what happened is that I tried to tell these people about Dave, and I could tell like they did not believe what I was saying.
Yeah.
The story was unbelievable. And so I got that idea, like, you know, oh well, here's this person that nobody would believe these stories about, and then that just opened itself up to, you know, when I picked up the guitar. I mean, sometimes it's just like you pick up a guitar and your hand goes to a certain chord, and then, you know, I'd read about these like beatnik writers who even if they made a typo, they wouldn't erase it. They would try to come up with a word that, you know, that like if you hit a P instead of a D, he'd be like, okay, what word starts with P? You know, and so sometimes it's like you pick up your guitar and you play a, you know, an F chord, and you think, well, okay, this is an F. You know,
yeah,
you know, and maybe later you might change it to G because you go, well, it's really hard to play an F.
It's a good process, though.
But yeah, you sort of like you have to kind of get these little things, these little. You know, like climbing a mountain, you get this little stronghold, this little place that you can hold on to, and then you got to stick with that and see what develops around that. And it's just, you know, I used to write a lot more songs than I do now, because I think as you've done it for a while, you start self-editing too much.
Yeah,
you
know, overthink it a little bit.
You'll edit yourself out of doing something that could have been a great idea. I've been trying to do stuff a little bit different. My wife, Angie, we have a Rolling Stones party for her birthday every year where all the bands learn a bunch of Stone songs. And so this year I usually try to get somebody to sing with us too. Like, so we have a Mick Jagger, you know, up there. And
I'm unavailable this year. I'm sorry, dude.
It's October, man.
I can't make it.
Busy October 28th. I was listening to these Stones records I hadn't really listened to that in a while, in a long time. Or I had never listened to them with headphones on. And I started hearing, like, you know, you can hear all these edits and places that things or I mean, you can't really you
old
can't,
school. Yeah,
you can't hear the edit like in a negative way, but you can tell they were just jamming on this riff,
right?
And then you know, and then Jagger comes in and starts singing over it, and then they went back and cut and pasted that stuff together to make to be the right lengths.
Yeah,
and there's some that are just funny because there's some that like there's an intro to the song that is roughly close to the rest of the song, but it's not. It's right. not the same. You know, and I'm like, what is this intro has a different like,
right.
because at one time it used to be like that, and then it sounded good, so they stuck it on. You know, yeah. So I've been thinking in terms like I want to try to make some music more like that, like come up with some. I have a ton of like guitar hooks and things that I've come up with that I don't have words for yet. And I want to try to sit down and record those either, you know, either cheaply with a drum machine and then start figuring out how to paste that stuff together and just kind of work from a different process because the old, you know, sitting in a chair with the trusty acoustic guitar here
yeah.
has, that process has slowed down a lot for me over the years.
Well, so, you know, it's all right.
That is all right.
What are you, 47?
Something like that.
Yeah.
somewhere.
It's my there. All my generation is turning 50 this year.
I know.
Year,
it's so amazing, huh?
One after the other, we're hearing about, oh my God, I'm 50. I'm like, dude, I was 50 the first of the years of Cry Me a River. Yeah. And there's really no difference, you know.
No, there really
but,
isn't.
Is this the same guitar you've been using all these years?
This is the guitar that I got post Last Man on Earth, because the Last Man on Earth, the official Last Man on Earth guitar,
yeah,
it is in very bad shape, and it also took a spill. I had some guitar case that I don't know. I was walking out of El Patio, and I tossed my guitar around my back, and the snap thing came off, and my guitar hit the street in Old Mesilla and cracked the headstock, which I've had repaired. But yeah, that guitar's not really.
It's never the same.
It's never been the same. It's beautiful though. It looks almost like Willie Nelson's guitar. You know?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. I was thinking you had this cleaned up, if it's the same, because I remembered the...
Got a little bit of action on it, too.
Yeah, it does, yeah. That's where your my little palm finger. Hits it, right?
Yeah.
Is that little finger?
Yeah, it's my little finger. Yeah.
I have to see, like... Where can people see like videos of you playing and stuff
guys,
like
there's
that?
So much stuff now. It's so easy to get all that stuff going.
YouTube channel or something?
Yeah, I think I do have a YouTube channel, but I'm not really on top of that. The website, which is just my name, ericheislaw.com, has a lot of good info. And I started writing a blog that's not like you know, we're doing this with our career and we're doing that with our career. My blog's more about memories. And I'm hoping to do some interviews with some musicians, not really interviews, but just sit down and have lunch or something with some
conversations,
musicians
yeah.
that nobody knows who these people are and they did a bunch of great stuff. That's one thing I'm trying to get going to. But so there's a blog there on the website that has some stories, some of these types of, you know, Capital Bar types of stories.
Right. And, there's no end once you get going.
And the website has links to YouTube videos and then the record is up on Bandcamp, which is a really cool platform. It has a lot of information on it. And all that stuff is linked from there. And then I've got a band page on Facebook. And
right. And
so real easy to find. And been playing a whole lot in Austin. I sort of had a shakeup where some of the guys that were playing with me, you know, one guy wanted to take a break. You know, one guy got a gig doing something else. And so I've got like a new... I'm just playing with a trio, me playing my trusty Telecaster and two other guys.
Yeah.
But we've been doing it a whole lot. We've been rehearsing and learning a bunch of new songs, and I've got some new songs. So I've been having some really good, fun, energetic live gigs going on. And we play every single weekend and go to Fort Worth or San Antonio or, you know, wherever.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So these are big trips to just play for the weekend.
It's only like I'm going to Fort Worth, like going to Albuquerque.
Yeah,
it's just like driving to Albuquerque and opening for Naomi at the launch pad.
Did we tell that story
to each other?
Well, you know, we'll tell that story next time you come through. We talked about it earlier. I don't think we recorded it though.
Yeah,
that's to be continued on the next show. Well, look, we're at about an hour. I know you got another interview out of town.
Yeah, going down to El Paso to see my friend at K-Tip.
You guys are in demand, you know. What can you do? But I appreciate you coming in.
Well, thanks for making the reaching out. You know, I've been wanting to come by and do the show after I heard the great stuff that you did with the Mystic Spaceman and the other guys and Jason Chaffee.
Well, I'm happy to do it. And like I say, anything local, I'm on it, man. So So very good. Well, listen, thanks again, and you owe me one more hour somewhere along the way.
All right, we'll do it again.
Okay, man. Thank you, Eric Hysa, and we'll be back right after this.
Thank you.